Time to take a look at the wonderful world of wildlife here in Wisconsin. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today, and great to have back David Drake and Jamie Knack. David, a professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. He's also a UW Extension Wildlife Specialist. David, good to see you. Jamie Knack is a UW Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist, also in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. And Jamie, good to see you.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks, Larry.
Well, we have lots to talk about today, and we certainly welcome, as you listen to these two experts talk, we welcome your wildlife questions or maybe your observations. I hope you'll join in. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Well, we've been having some nice fall weather in the state, to be honest. I'm sure lots of people are looking forward to getting outside to enjoy it. I've spent a little time outside. I bet you guys have too. Where can you go to find out what's happening? There's a lot of good places.
This is a great time of the year. I'm definitely biased, but fall is for sure my favorite season. So these cooler nights and 60, 70 degree days have just been wonderful. And you can definitely feel that fall is on the horizon. Just wanted to remind folks, there's a lot of great opportunities to get outdoors, whether it's at your local nature center, a state park, in your backyard, on property that you own. But a few things that you might take a look at are, on the Department of Natural Resources website, if you just did a search for Get Outdoors, the keywords Get Outdoors, it'll come up to a calendar of events. And from there, you can search over a particular period of time. So maybe you're looking for something to do this weekend or over the course of the fall. And there'll be a lot of events at state parks, like bird hikes that are going on, or I know there's an upcoming night hike at Coleraine-Andre State Park, just lots of different educational programs and activities as well. So great
lots
website.
Lots of family-friendly.
Very family-friendly.
I always like Horicon Marsh.
Yeah, Horicon Marsh is really a combination of three entities that are doing programming. So between the federal side of the marsh, so the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the department side, the state side, and then you have a wonderful friends group and the Haven Nature Center, they get together and produce a publication on all sorts of educational programming, and that too is available, and maybe we can link to that. But they offer weekly nature walks at Horicon. Fall would be fabulous, about mid-October when there's 100,000 geese on site, and certainly it's a great place for watching birds as they start migration, whether it be hawks or shorebirds that we're kind of at the tail end of.
There's a boat tour as well. I've never done it. I'm always hiking out there, but I've watched it and thought, I got to do that sometime.
So there's the education center. There's a wonderful education center there right at Horicon.
That's
worth
it's
going
beautiful.
To. It's
just,
really
just got rebuilt,
well done.
Actually, and reopened a couple years ago. So it's almost brand new.
History of the marsh, discussions on how it's managed. Worth a stop or a trip just for that. But they, the staff there, lead paddles and canoe trips from time to time. But I think you may be talking about Blue Heron Landing.
Yes.
That's a business that you can do trips. And we've done that as a family, you go on a tour with them and they take you into the marsh and talk about the history. And obviously you want to bring binoculars because you always see some pretty interesting stuff. So some really exciting things to do to get you outside.
Well, hunting is another activity, David, that people look forward to. Many people do anyway. Seasons are going to be opening starting pretty soon.
Yeah, so the first season was September 1st with morning doves. And you have fall turkey, and you've got waterfowl seasons, which people really enjoy. And obviously the culmination would be the deer season and the nine-day gun deer season centered around Thanksgiving period. But, so starting September 1st, the hunting season is for a variety of game species we're going to play, and we'll continue on through the winter, and then you get into obviously trapping seasons, and we'll start in October and run through January, February, depending on the species and the types of traps used and things like that. So plenty of opportunity to get out there, whether you want to consume something in terms of harvesting a wildlife species, or you just want to go out and bird watch or hike or see the fall colors. fish, whatever the case might be. There's a ton of opportunities. And as you mentioned, it's a great thing to do with kids. You know, we've probably talked a little bit on this program, but that nature deficit disorder where kids are not getting outside like they used to in previous generations. And, you know, when you don't get outside, obviously there's some consequences for that. You're not as physically healthy. You don't have appreciation for the natural world and a connection to that. And so it is vitally important to get your kids outside as well as get yourself outside.
One little thing to note, that this is for deer hunting. This is the latest that the season is, you know, it rotates a little bit.
Yeah.
And so this is the latest the deer hunt ever
can
is.
Be.
It can be in the state. So you've been thinking, oh, middle of the month? No, it's near the end of the month this year.
Yep.
I'd also like to maybe plug the Learn to Hunt opportunities. This is a great time to be thinking about them. So the Department of Natural Resources offers Learn to Hunt. Many friends, groups, and organizations involved that put them on. In fact, it's something you can get folks together to do yourself. But if you go to the Department of Natural Resources page, again, search box, just type in LTH, abbreviation for Learn to Hunt, and you'll get to a list of upcoming events. I had just looked. There's lots of pheasant hunting opportunities coming up in the next month. And basically, these Learn to Hunt opportunities are an opportunity for a novice to try a type of hunting for a given species with a mentor, a seasoned hunter. And so it includes some classroom time where you're learning about species biology and rules and regulations, gun safety, hunting ethics. There's also a field component where you're becoming proficient with the firearm that you would be using for that particular animal. And then there's an actual mentored hunt as part of these. Mm-hmm. So for anybody that's thinking about, you know, maybe trying hunting or learning more about it, they also really gear these towards family and women and something to think about. So DNR's website on Learn to Hunt.
But there's you know, a lot of people, I think, or fewer and fewer people are hunting in society these days, not just in Wisconsin. And so there's no pressure at all if you want to go do it. Just go and have fun. And if you don't feel like doing the field component, there's no pressure to do that, no obligation that you continue hunting beyond that. Although that's, they'd like to use this as an avenue to get you into the sport. But so it's a fun thing to do.
And I, as a friend and former producer, a current producer of our afternoon shows, Judith Sears-Mosselman, signed up for, I think she did the pheasants.
Yeah.
She did the
pheasants.
Wonderful time doing it. She's still, she's not hunting, but she did have a great time and learned an awful lot.
Yeah.
And had fun.
Well, and I say I teach some hunting programs on campus as well for our wildlife students to make sure that they receive their degree and have exposure to the role that hunting and conservation play, or hunting plays in conservation. And again, our goal is not to recruit them, but really to make sure that they understand that value and that role that hunting plays. So even if you go through the Learn to Hunt and you're not interested, there's knowledge for you, right?
Absolutely. And all of that hunting, anything you buy that supports hunting, so be it guns, ammunition, you know, camouflage clothing, tree stands, whatever the case is, all of that money goes into a federal pot in a, through the federal excise tax, and then it gets distributed to each state. And so that money does come back to each state to help provide funding for continued and sustained management of the wildlife resource. So it's a and although it does primarily benefit game species, there's a lot of non-game species that both directly and indirectly benefit from that. So it's hunting is very beneficial from an economic, social, recreational standpoint.
You know, one of the I was thinking about apps. I was looking at my phone, and I've got the DNR app. Talk a little bit about apps, perhaps, and there's a lot out there. I really like the DNR one.
Yeah, well, that's good to hear. I have to spend some more time navigating. They've made some changes. So the DNR has a Hunt Wild mobile app, and it's loaded with some new features that are going to be available this fall. So if you've been using it, continue to check it out. But that app will show you property boundaries. It'll give you shooting hours based on your location. So it adjusts for
the sunrise, sunset,
yep, depending on where your location is.
Aerial view. Of where you are.
Mm-hmm. Yep, you can get into the regulations on there, species-specific information as well. And then I know a couple of things that are new this year. They're trying to make it easier for hunters to plan they're testing for deer, so mm-hmm. chronic wasting disease testing. So both to be able to find a sampling location, and then also where the deer carcass disposal locations are, and that has been integrated into that app feature.
Well, that's a dandy. I really I like to sit out in the woods and just look and say, well, here I am. But just to go through the information in there, there's a lot in there. Yeah. I'm looking forward to
it. Well, and when you look at an aerial photo, I think it really changes your perception of where things are laid out on a given property that you're hunting. You know, when you look in relation from a bird's eye view, to me, it doesn't always line up the way I see it on the ground. So it's neat to see that. And you can look for different features like bottlenecks and pinch points and things like that. So it can be helpful for scouting.
John from Star Prairie called to say he saw a pair of whooping cranes near Toma and wanted to know when they start migrating and where they could have come from.
Well, John, that's a good question. So whooping cranes are one of the two species of cranes we have in the state of Wisconsin. The most common you would see is the sandhill crane, which is typically a big, about 4 foot tall gray bird with a red crest on its head. The whooping cranes are, and the sandhill cranes are not endangered. They're not a game species in the state of Wisconsin, but they're not endangered by any stretch of the imagination. Whooping cranes are an endangered species. They're typically all white. And when you see them flying, they're all white with black wingtips. And they are prehistoric looking. Both the sandhill cranes and the whooping cranes are prehistoric looking when they fly. Very, very interesting animals. Whooping cranes will start migrating. It's probably a little bit early for them to start migrating now, typically. But the population here in Wisconsin is up in the Sandhill and the Cedar region, and it's called an experimental population. So even though they are endangered, the whooping crane species is endangered, because this is an experimental population where they are able to experiment with different ways of getting them to migrate behind a ultralight airplane, for example, or doing some other things like that. That they are there's some exceptions, and they're not. I don't know how to put this. There's some exceptions that they're not because they're an experimental population. They're still an endangered species, but researchers are able to do a little bit more with these birds than
with these birds in
Wisconsin than they could with the birds that might be down in Wood Buffalo National Park and up in Canada or down in Aransas in Texas or whatever the case is. So anyway, long story short, they will start migrating here pretty soon. A lot of times you'll see them following an ultralight airplane because they're teaching the young birds how to fly and migrate south. And if you want to see them in the summertime, go up to Nisida and Sandhill. That's where the experimental population is based.
Let's take a call here. Dave in Orfordville will give you a chance now. Hi, Dave. Thank you for joining in.
Hey, Larry. A great show as usual.
Thank you.
Really enjoy your guests. I just wanted to put a plug in for some of the organizations throughout the state. If people are looking to continue throughout the year doing things, organizations like Trout Unlimited, Pheasants Forever, the Muskie Guys, Ducks Unlimited, all of those organizations have outdoor experiences for work days and things like that. And they also do a lot of the youth hunt things and stuff like that. And people can find them online all the time. You can go anywhere and Google them. And it really is a great opportunity for people to get involved in the outdoors and conservation and that kind of thing.
Dave, thanks a lot for calling. Comment?
Yeah, thanks, Dave. I would just say, having been involved in a lot of those organizations, it's a pay-it-forward type attitude, but there's a lot that you get individually in return for being active in these organizations, too. So they're just great functions of being able to put dollars on the ground, habitat on the ground, raise awareness, education, get people involved in conservation. So thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Dave. Appreciate it very much.
I was just going to add really quick that even though you know, a lot of these organizations are species-specific focus, so Pheasants Forever are obviously looking for pheasants, or Rough Grouse Society is looking for rough grouse, Whitetails Unlimited, whatever, that what is done, especially with habitat management and things like that, it benefits just an incredible host of species, even though it is a single-species focus for that particular advocacy group.
And thanks again, Dave. And Mark and Susan, they're the resident managers of Goose Pond Sanctuary, emailed that the sanctuary in Columbia County, now a great place to visit. Yesterday, they counted a flock of 95 great egrets. And this morning, they had over 800 monarchs roosting in their yard. The great egrets and the great blue herons are probably feeding on tiger salamanders and frogs. Yesterday, with the rain in the morning, the tiger salamanders were abundant on the roads around Goose Pond. The hiking trails are great to view the prairie and the monarchs. Monarchs will be tagged at Goose Pond on 3 days in September, right?
Yeah, that's great. Thanks, Mark and Susan, for chiming in with some of that information. So it's Goose Pond is just a wonderful place to visit.
Yeah.
So,
beautiful place.
But this time of year especially. And I was going to mention the monarch tagging. There are events both at Goose Pond, but Horicon will have some. I believe the Natural Resources Foundation still has some field trips that you can sign up for that involve monarch tagging. So,
And you go to MadisonAudubon.org.
To get to the Goose Pond one. Yeah,
because Goose Pond is part of Madison Audubon. Even though we don't necessarily consider insects wildlife, but there have just been a ton of monarchs this summer.
Yeah.
It has been a really good year for monarchs.
Very good year for monarchs. Well, we're talking today with David Drake and Jamie Knack. David, I think they're both connected with UW Extension, as a matter of fact, and also with the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. You can join in. What have you been seeing, or what comments or questions do you have? Give a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. Dave Potratz, our engineer today, Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Looking at wildlife here in the state of Wisconsin with our two guests, David Drake and Jamie Knack from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison, also UW Extension. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. Questions, comments, experiences, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. I'm going to get you on pretty quickly. Fall migration underway.
Yeah.
The early migrants, there's some early fall migrants.
Yeah, they're moving along. So bats have started to migrate. They probably started migrating as early as maybe the middle of August, something like that. So they're moving. That's really the only migratory mammal we have in the state of Wisconsin. And then most of the other migratory animals are all birds. So, you know, some of the warblers are going already. Some of the other early migratory birds, I think, will be moving along here. And right now, when they start migrating, they're waiting for a north wind because they're all going south, it's an energy issue. They want to conserve as much energy as they possibly can. They only have so much energy stored, so they're not going to fly in a counter wind. So anytime you have good, strong north winds blowing, then the migratory birds will start moving along, and it's pretty neat to see. Fun to see them all. The frustration right now in the fall is that the fall warblers are not always the easiest to identify because they've got a bit of a different plumage than you'd see them in the spring. So that can be a little confusing and frustrating at times, but it's a neat time of the year, and fall migration is always a little bit longer than spring migration because the birds aren't as in a big rush to get up here on the breeding grounds like they are in the spring. In the fall, they take a little bit longer time to get moving, and so migration might start as early as, early September. It might go as late as end of November, something like that.
And judging from what Mark and Susan from Goose Pond Sanctuary said, the monarchs must be getting into the migratory mode as well. They had 800 of them.
Yeah, most of the banding opportunities that I noticed are mid-September, so maybe not this weekend, but the weekend after. So I would suspect they're coordinating that with the peak migration. Please.
Kate in Rio has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Kate.
Hi, good morning, Larry. We have a small bit of acreage. We have about 6 acres in prairie, and we have a lot of monarchs this year, and we have a wonderful display of milkweed. But my brother was down from Red Granite, and he noticed this on his acreage, too. The milkweed is not setting seed. There are very few pods, and we're kind of concerned about it because we usually have, a huge milkweed array, and we let the seeds go and blow them around and have fun with that with our 4-year-old grandson. But any comments about what's going on, and should we be worried about milkweed for next year?
Well, Kate, thanks for the question. I will say David and I are probably not experts in terms of plant specifics, but whether this is helpful or not. I live probably 5 miles away from you, out of Rio on 5 acres, and we also have prairie, a lot of perennials and milkweed, and we do have pods on the milkweed plants. Now, they're still really green. I haven't popped any open of recent. They're just not quite ready, but I know we have the pods from mowing the trails and stuff. We're certainly seeing them. So I'm not sure what is going on there.
Yeah, I'm not sure either.
It may have been a weather issue from spring. If you happen to have something just in your area, it was kind of a crazy spring.
Yeah.
But, so it could be that.
But in the past, you said you've had milkweed produce seed.
That's why I think it might be weather-related.
Yeah, it could just be a one-year anomaly, and you get through this year, and next year it might be better.
Yeah.
For sure.
Something might have just stressed them out with being able to produce the pods in that given area.
So stay hopeful.
Yes. Okay.
Thanks very much for calling. Sue in Brookfield, we'll go to you next. Hi.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a comment and a question. My comment is for another resource for fun outdoor activities for this month is the Gathering Waters website. Gathering Waters is the statewide organization of land trusts and conservancies, and they have a program called Land Trust Days. And if you go to the Gathering Waters website, there's activities all over the state that are free and open to all ages, and it's just a wonderful program.
Sue, is that a specific day, or is it over a month?
It's over the whole month of September and partly into October.
Great.
Yeah.
It's a different lot of activities.
Okay, good. Another great resource to check out.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Yeah, there's so many good organizations. Maybe as you're listening in, you've got one that you want to talk about too. You're welcome to join in the conversation. There were a number of bear sightings this year in pretty populated areas. Do you think we'll see any recurrence of that this fall?
Well, the typical time I would be in the spring for the dispersing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think when their breeding is fall breeding. Is that correct? I think that's right.
Yep.
So they'd be pushing out, the females would be pushing out their 2-year-old cubs, typically, although Wisconsin's bears don't necessarily follow the every other year of breeding. Sometimes quality habitat, you might have a sow that breeds every year, but typically they need to push out those. They're not cubs at that point. They're a yearling for that breeding to occur. So typically it could be fall dispersal, or not even dispersal, but movement or in the spring after hibernation. But we often do see bears further south. I mean, certainly their habitat is north and central Wisconsin, and it's not uncommon to have bears showing up in this area as well. I mean, we've certainly had them over the years. So typically they're going to be dispersing young males looking for their own territory, and they may stay for a while. They may go back. I'm not sure what the furthest south breeding or, you know, a sow with cubs report has been in Wisconsin. I haven't stayed up on that, but they certainly have expanded their range, and their population's doing really, really well. So somewhere between 25 and 30,000 bears. And in fact, that season opened up on Wednesday, I believe.
Mm. What about, though we're on bears, what species will be getting ready to hibernate?
Yeah, well, bears for sure. So bears are a true hibernator. You know, we've got 8 bat species in the state of Wisconsin. 4 of those bat species are resident species, so they'll hibernate. Those are true hibernators as well. Groundhogs, also called woodchucks, they'll hibernate. Chipmunks, 13-line ground squirrels, what we call rest of hibernators. So they'll sleep for about 2 or 3 weeks, wake up, go to the bathroom, eat, go back to sleep. So that doesn't sound like such a bad life. Mm-hmm. And so those are some true hibernators. A couple of the mouse species, so the jumping mice, the 2 jumping mouse species are hibernators as well.
And then the whole collection of herptiles, so your reptiles and amphibians. They can't really migrate, but they may migrate to a hibernaculum where they conjugate and overwinter, whether it be under the water, under the mud, getting below the frost line. So our herptile Diversity is rather bleak from about October to April as they're as they're hibernating. So they're groups of animals that we really only see in the spring and throughout the summer and late fall. And,
Steve, go ahead.
I was just going to say, so what drives all of that? The primary driver of all of that is day length. So as the day length starts shortening, these animals' physiology starts changing. And it tells them, hey, it's time to start getting prepared to go out in hibernation. So it's interesting that everything is tied to day length, and that's what wakes them up in the springtime too. So as the day length starts to increase and the warm things get warmer, the soil starts thawing out, we get rain instead of snow, and it's pretty interesting how all that is tied to day length.
And we've got, I think, 60 days until we change our times. We fall back.
And oh, yeah. Oh, good gosh. I know. And the days are already getting
60
shorter.
60 days,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's right.
Today. Steve emailed, wondered, I think you mentioned when the bear hunt begins in Wisconsin, but maybe mention that again. But then he wanted some more information regarding bears, particularly the count and how many animals do we have in the state?
Yeah, so let's start with the seasons. There's a few different zones within the state, and there's also a bear management plan that is being updated kind of as we speak. So those zones may change in the future, but not this year. So all the zones remain the same as they have been in the past, at least for this year. So the season in Zone C, where dogs are not permitted as a method of harvest, using dogs to trailing hounds to trail bears. Mm-hmm. In Zone C, that opened on September 4th, which I believe was
today.
Yeah. Wednesday. So, and then the other zones in the state where dogs are allowed as part of the hunt, that would open either September 4th or September 11th. Again, just kind of depends on where you are, what zone you're in. So, really start September 4th, but again, you need to pay attention a little bit to the zones and so on.
And how many do you, what's the last estimate you saw?
Yeah, I want to say like around 26,000, like in that general ballpark, plus or minus a few thousand.
Yeah, and I think the first time they did the tetracycline study, they were estimated as high as 39,000 mm-hmm. possibly. So nobody's quite sure exactly. It's hard to count them. They don't always stand still and be counted. But the range, you know, it was from 13,000 to 39,000, somewhere mm-hmm. in that range. But I think they're trying to tighten that confidence interval up a little bit now with this. They're doing another population estimate of bears.
Yeah, so the tetracycline study, what that entailed, and there's been two iterations of that, was using tetracycline that is rolled up in, I think they used, it was all bacon, in a box on a tree, and those sets were put all over kind of a sample across the north with the idea that bears would be the only animal able to access, break open that box and eat the bacon, which came with that tetracycline. The tetracycline stains the bone. So when hunters, so that was the mark.
It permanently stains the bone.
Stains the bone. So
doesn't
bears,
hurt the bears.
Doesn't hurt them.
No, it's just, tetracycline is it's an antibiotic. Just like if you go to the doctor and you're not feeling well, they'll give you tetracycline sometimes.
So bears were marked. And then when hunters harvested a bear in the fall, they were sent, if they had a permit to harvest a bear, they were sent a packet to how to sample, collect a rib. And so those ribs were then collected from the harvested bear, and that is the recapture rate. So you can put that into a model, and based on your mark, number of animals marked, number of animals recaptured, you can get an estimate of that population. So that was done twice. Now we can no longer use tetracycline because of that antibiotic and I think the concern of it coming into the human mm-hmm. food stream. So they are doing a new process this year, the DNR is, to estimate bear populations. And that involves setting up, again, some type of a bait station, but then having barbed wire around it to be able to collect hair. And so with hair, you can get a DNA sample. And again, you can figure out what animals are marked. And then I assume in the fall we'll be mm-hmm. having hunters collect a hair sample from the bear they harvested. It's really
a little easier to do.
Well, really fascinating
You
know, progress in terms of the research and the ability to estimate these populations.
Yeah. And the barbed wire is called a hair snare.
Yeah.
So that's what we call it in the wildlife field.
Hair snares.
So once they get that hair, then they can do a genetic analysis and they can see which they don't know which specific bear. They know the genetic of that specific bear. And then they can also look at relatedness about other bears that are coming, and they can also see how many times they're picking that bear up on other hair snares around and things like that. So, yeah, it's pretty interesting.
We have Alan Green Bay email, and this goes back to monarchs. He wonders, how in the heck do you tag a monarch? It can't be like a goose banding or anything.
It is not. Obviously, monarchs are very light-weighted creatures, very fragile. And so essentially it's like a little decal, a sticky decal that you take. Usually it's round, relatively small. It might be, I don't know, less than the size of a scruff cap of a water bottle. Less than that diameter size.
I think of the inspection stickers you find on your clothing.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. Inspected by number 14. Stickers. Yes. And then you just stick that on the wing. Yep. And so it's just this little sticky adhesive that goes on the wing.
Yep. And they'd have a unique number.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep.
There you go. And then
And then they release it, and then they'll if people see monarchs and they see that decal, then they'll try to find out the number and they'll report it. And so we do that a lot with bird banding in the United States, bird banding in other parts of the world too. But so the idea is you put a unique identifying band on a bird, especially as it's migrating, and then you try to find that bird either someplace else in its migratory route when it comes back up. But the issue is most of what we do in the wildlife field in terms of research and population monitoring and things like that is terribly labor intensive and very ineffective in terms of using your resources effectively. But it's the best technique you have. So bird banding, for example, I think the band return is about 8%. So you
8%.
Might, yeah. So of all,
and
the
you
birds,
mean on passerines or
yeah, generally on passerines. Mm-hmm. So all the birds you band, you might see that bird again 8% of the time.
Yeah.
So even
and then
though,
we use bands for waterfowl as well. Yeah. So and that helps get into the. You know, what the harvest is going to look like and
absolutely.
Set the harvest. So,
but even that's not that high, surprisingly. Just, mm-hmm. And so you think about something like a monarch, how small that animal is, and then you got to have this little tiny adhesive decal on its wing. It's not surprising you don't see a lot of the monarch band returns, if you will, or tag returns.
You need to have a little training to be able to put
yeah,
that
and good
on,
eyes.
I would think.
And good eyes.
And good
yeah.
eyes. So that lets me out.
How are you at catching them?
Yeah, right.
Well,
yeah.
You can run the net.
I could probably run the net.
Yeah.
But the rest of it I'd have to put to somebody else.
Yeah.
Rita emailed that last week she heard a strange sound in her house, and she discovered a turkey that kept pecking the window on her basement level. She figured it saw her reflection. She's got a video of it. I was going to try and play the video. the turkey is pecking away at the window.
Yeah, that's we can't get the video up here, Rita, but we've seen this plenty of times with turkeys. Sandhill cranes would do this a lot of times. You hear this a lot of times with songbirds like robins or cardinals or goldfinch or other birds like that. And typically it is they see the reflection and they think that it's another male in their territory. They don't realize that they're actually seeing themselves in the window. And most of the time this happens in the spring during breeding season, so it's a little unusual for it to happen now, especially because turkeys will now start to flock up here for the winter. And when they flock up, they typically are not that aggressive toward each other. So it's a little unusual what's happening now, but most likely that's what's going on is it sees its reflection and thinks it's a competitor.
Guy in Grand Marsh, it's your turn. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I was wondering about nighthawks. I never hardly see them anymore. And I was wondering, did they go extinct or are they on the verge of extinction?
No, nighthawks, common nighthawks are around and they're pretty common. Obviously, they're called common nighthawk for that for many reasons, but that's one of them. Super cool birds. They're, I don't know, Jamie, what do you think about 8 inches, 10 inch, 12 inch wingspan, something like that?
Yeah, that sounds right.
They've got usually a white white band that runs from the front to the back of their wing. That's how you tell them. And they also have some very kind of angular wings, which is kind of neat. Night hawks, so a lot of times when the sun's starting to go down, you'll see them. I haven't seen a lot this year, but usually I see them actually when we're coming back from coverts. I see them driving down Highway 39 a lot of times, but they are usually following insect migration, so dragonflies in particular. And when the dragonflies are migrating, you'll see just hordes of nighthawks flying the skies eating those dragonflies.
Yeah, this is certainly the time of the year that they are starting to conjugate and migrate. As David said, where we live too, we have more open prairie, and we do see them at night, especially if we have a bonfire on the weekend and we're out there for a period of time. We almost always will hear a few at this time of the year. So, but they're currently migrating.
Guy, thanks so much for calling. You can join in, too, by the way, 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We had an email, by the way. Karen emailed a photo of a deer she saw in Minocqua. I'm able to expand that photo, and that is a very large
is it?
Non-typical buck.
Wow.
Yeah, as someone who is currently monitoring game cameras and getting them out into the woods to start patterning some deer, that would be something that would be welcomed.
Wow.
It's beautiful.
Enormous.
Still in velvet from what I can see, and they'll start scraping here pretty quickly getting rid of that velvet.
We should say that might be a good reason to talk a little bit about driving right now in the fall time, because deer are starting to move quite a bit because, as Jamie mentions, that the breeding season is getting started here. The sun is going down a little bit earlier, and the closer the sun starts to going down when we start commuting home for the evening. And deer are what we call crepuscular animals primarily, so they're active mostly around sunup, sundown. So just now through at least the end of November, as you're driving with the sun starting to go down, just slow down a little bit, be a little bit more observant and vigilant, and keep your eye open for deer.
We're also at a peak of kind of carrying capacity, and you think about all the fawns.
Yeah.
And those fawns are now mobile and not very experienced with traffic and people on. So, yeah, definitely good to be alert.
Take another call. Susie in New Berlin, thank you for calling.
Hi. I am calling about two things. First, there was a woman that called about her milkweed pods. Her milkweed not having pods, correct? Yep. I had that happen last year. I have evidently two or three different kinds of milkweeds, and the ones in the backyard had pods. Everything was fine. The ones in the front yard, 6 feet tall, no pods. And this year, 6 feet tall and pods, lots and lots and lots. So she should just not worry about it. They'll be fine next year, I'm guessing. Yeah. The other thing is I'm real proud of my bird feeder and all the different kinds of birds that I see in it. And then one day I looked out, the dog was barking like crazy. Two sandhill cranes. We're standing at my bird feeder, and I'm in New Berlin, not the woodsy part and not the field part. I'm in town, So that was kind of fun. So all the neighbors came out. Everybody was taking pictures, and they walked up and down the road a little and visited other houses. And then they took off, and I know we have sandhill cranes around here a lot and blue herons, but I never saw one like in somebody's front yard before. That was pretty fun.
That is pretty cool.
I thought I would. Yeah, yeah. Do you guys still want anybody to report sandhills? Because we have them nesting right next to the Walmart. I have photos of a pair walking through the Walmart parking lot.
So, Susie, to my knowledge, I don't think we being the Department of Natural Resources, I don't know that the state is collecting information on sandhill sightings. However, we do have an annual crane count, and that is a set day. Is that April?
Yeah.
In April, where there's a crane count. So that is a day that is set aside for volunteers to count the cranes they see in their location on that day as a means of getting an index on how that population is doing. And so overall observations, daily observations outside of that day, they're probably not collecting. A whooping crane, yes. They would probably be interested in that, especially nesting.
Well, the other thing, if you do want to report it, you can go to eBird,
the
Wisconsin eBird, and just report your sighting there, and people might be interested in that. And the only other comment I'll make quickly is you were a little surprised that they're in a more of an urban environment. So I ride my bike to work most of the days, and as I was riding onto campus, if you're familiar with campus, over by the UW Hospital and the VA Hospital, there's a set of train tracks that run right along University Avenue, which is a very, very urban corridor that has, I don't know, probably tens of thousands of cars on it every single day. There was a pair of sandhill cranes just sitting in the train tracks eating in between all the railroad ties. And so sandhill cranes, the point of that is sandhill cranes are actually becoming a very urbanized species of bird. And it's not uncommon to see them in cities, even in right downtown in the middle of cities. If there's some green space or wetland around, they're around there. So that's pretty neat that they came to your backyard feeder.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. David Drake and Jamie Knack from the UW Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and UW Extension, our guests today. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network, taking a look at the world of wildlife with our guests today, David Drake and Jamie Knack. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. We have a number of callers online, and let's just take another call here. Dennis in Sussex, you're next. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. I live in an area with very large oak trees, kind of a forest and everything, and I have bird feeders out in the yard. And I have a loyal following of flying squirrels that I feed a handful of peanuts to at night. And recently we were out of town, and when we came back, you know, there was no squirrels coming around, no flying squirrels coming around. And I was worried that maybe something had happened to them or they'd maybe somehow been poisoned or something. But we got to looking around, and we noticed there weren't any gray squirrels either, you know, like we're used to seeing. And my question is, I was wondering if it might have anything to do with the acorn crop coming in. Are they finding other food, and maybe they'll come back later in the, you know, when the weather gets cold?
Yeah, my first thought is that if you have been having them throughout this last few weeks and now they've just disappeared, that something within their ecology, their cycle has changed where they're not coming into your feeders. So we see that with hummingbirds when they have their babies. We may not see them at the hummingbird feeders as often. They might be foraging on insects instead. So you see different activity depending on what's going on. So they could have a late litter. I mean, the squirrels have multiple litters a season. But it could also be that another food has become available and they're focusing on that.
Yeah, makes good sense to me. Thank you very much for calling, Dennis. Rick in Monroe will turn to you now. Hi, Rick.
Hi, I was wondering if you guys could give us an update on the current prevalence of CWD in our deer herd, specifically from about Columbia County down towards the state line.
Boy, I do not have that in front of me, but to get that information is very straightforward. If you just go to the Department of Natural Resources website, type in CWD, and they will have maps showing prevalence and also just you know, test results from the last season and the years before that. So I suspect that we'll hear more about CWD in the coming weeks. There's a few things going on right now. As the state gears up for hunting season. So I think you'll hear information about what surveillance efforts are underway for this coming year, efforts to help hunters, both educate, encourage, and help hunters be able to submit samples for testing, and then also what the options will be for disposing of carcasses. And there's changes that came into effect on September 1st in terms of baiting and feeding regulations. So there was a captive elk in Burnett County that tested positive. And based on the baiting and feeding restrictions, it affected four counties. So Burnett, Barron, Polk, and Washburn. As of September 1st, there's no baiting or feeding. And that's based off of having a positive either captive or wild deer. This particular one was a captive elk. And it takes a 10-mile radius of that captive positive or wild positive and puts, in fact, a baiting and feeding ban. So the prevalence, I just can't, and it varies depending on where you're looking.
Yeah.
We have two CWD management zones in the state. So DNR website will be the most useful.
I would mention just in passing that next Wednesday, Preston Cole, who heads the DNR, will be our guest.
Excellent.
So he'll be on, and I'm sure
there'll be some questions.
Yeah, there'll be some questions relating to CWD on that program for
sure. Well, there's definitely, you know, current work being done in that area, which is great.
Yeah.
Thank you, Rick. On to Richard in Presque Isle. Hi, Richard.
Hi. Good morning, Larry. I lived up in Presque Isle now. I've been here for 80 years, and I'm wondering about two species. One is the bird, the tree swallow. I built 17 birdhouses years ago, and all of them were filled years ago. But now, in the past 5 years, I haven't seen a one. And my second question, leopard frogs. My jaw just dropped yesterday when I almost hit one with a lawnmower. I haven't seen one of those in 10 years. Huh. Can you give me any insight on the whether they're going extinct?
Okay.
Well, those are two species I would never would put together. Yeah. So tree swallows and leopard frogs. But no, both of those populations are actually very, very robust. And why you're not seeing them locally, I don't have a good answer for that necessarily. I mean, it could be that they're around. They're just not at your local specific location. Obviously, tree swallows are insectivores, so if the insects are not around or if somebody's using insecticides in your local area and the insect population's down, they may have to move someplace else. But tree swallows generally are very, very healthy in terms of numbers and not in any in population decline that I'm aware of at all. And same for leopard frogs. I think that they are generally pretty healthy from a population as well. So, you know, the one issue with frogs, just like most amphibians, that they are susceptible to a number of pollutants. So if you have soil contamination, water pollution, something like that, that may impact the local population or it might drive them out of an area. So if there's something that's happened environmentally that you may or may not be aware of, that could be an answer. But generally, those two species are actually pretty robust and doing quite well.
So, Richard, one question I would have is, I know you're talking about changes you've observed over a number of years, is maybe has the habitat changed? So where you have those tree swallow nest boxes, has that grown up now? Because that might be an indication their preference for the habitat has changed based on plant succession. And the leopard frogs, they'd be very dependent on water. So if the water resource in your area has changed over time, you may see fewer of them.
Or more.
Yeah.
As he saw one finally.
Yeah, right.
So, Richard, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Kim in Eau Claire has a comment for us. Hi, Kim.
Hi there. I had heard recently, I was talking to someone in the periphery of the DNR, and they said that if you have a fisher move into your area, your squirrel population will almost disappear in a very short time if you have a fisher in the area. Is that true?
Well, fishers are a predator, no doubt, and they're a pretty effective predator. And I don't doubt that they'll eat squirrels, but they eat a lot of other animals as well. So, fishers, to my knowledge, they don't concentrate their prey base just on squirrels. They'll eat, chipmunks and mice and a whole bunch of other things like that as well. So it is possible that maybe they've put a bit of a dent in the squirrel population, or either they've reduced the population by consuming them, or a lot of times if a predator moves in, the prey does become a little bit more vigilant or will move out of the general area. So that could be going on as well.
There you go, Richard. Thank you so much for calling. Kim in Eau Claire, hello. Oh, I'm sorry. Completely goofed that up. Let's go to Mike in Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Good afternoon. I have a cottage in Megawicca Lake.
Yes.
And that's adjacent to Delafield.
Yeah.
Every spring of the year, Delafield goes through and kills all the birds. They kill the geese and the ducks and everything else. And I'm wondering if this is a common practice in the inland lakes.
Well, so I don't know the specifics of Delafield, but the Canada goose population is rather abundant in the state of Wisconsin. And what we're primarily talking about are resident Canada geese. And those are the geese that are here year-round. Typically, they're more of an urban component, urban goose, so they're where you have, city lakes and ponds and commercial properties. You might have a landscape pond or something like that. So in certain areas of the state, and it's not just Wisconsin, they do this in other areas as well, but it is not uncommon to do what's called goose roundups, where they typically it's the United States Department of Agriculture Wildlife Services will come in and they will humanely round up and then euthanize a set number of geese to try to reduce the population in that immediate local area to reduce some of the negative impacts, such as goose droppings and over browsing of vegetation. Sometimes geese during the spring get a little aggressive toward people if they come too close to the nest. So the idea is to try to reduce those negative consequences of having too many geese in the area. And so Delafield very well may be doing that. I just don't know about the specifics. But it's a sustained program. It's very biologically based. It's responsible. And they're not trying to kill all the birds. They're trying to remove a set number of individuals to reduce the population by a bit.
There you go, Mike. Thanks for calling. Penny in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi.
Hi there.
What can we do for you?
Well, this morning I was doing a little, I'm making a survey for this weekend because I'm a part of Bird City. So I was looking up some facts about woodcock. And it reminded me that last spring and the one before, we had so much snow after the woodcock got here. And what do they eat when there's all this snow on the ground?
What do woodcock eat when there's snow on the ground?
Worms is primarily what they'll eat. They'll probe into there and get worms. And sometimes the soil, because of that microclimate, is actually warm enough that the insects can rise up toward the top of the soil layer.
So they'll do that. We can talk some more about that after we take a quick look at the news and weather and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. David Drake and Jamie Nack, our guests, they'll be with us right up till 12:30. I'm Larry Mueller, and we'll be back right after the news. Looking at Wisconsin's wildlife on the program today. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today. Really appreciate it as we visit with David Drake and Jamie Nack from UW Extension and the UW Madison Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Always great to have them come by. They come by every couple months to talk with us about what's going on in the out of doors. Certainly, if you have a question or comment, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Had some great photos. You can email us photos and questions as well at ideas@wpr.org. And just for a minute, I want to go back to Penny in Wisconsin Rapids, who had asked about what do woodcock eat in the spring, you know, when they come up here and then suddenly it snows. What happens?
Yeah, I mean, David hit it on the head. So they're definitely preferred diet is worms. I suspect in the winter when you or early spring when they migrate back, they're not migrating any further, whether it be south or north, that they have availability to resources. So they may have to hold up somewhere in central Wisconsin on their way to northern Wisconsin to wait for that snow to melt. But also they're able to find pockets where maybe south-facing, maybe near water, where that frost is out of the ground, and they're able to forage, even though the rest of the landscape is still white and the ground is frozen.
Makes good sense. Peg emailed that she saw a lone loon on Lake DeBay yesterday. Isn't this early for migrating south?
Probably not terribly early. I mean, it might be a little bit early, but you know, there's no schedule that says you can't leave before September 4th. So the birds will kind of come and go, and the loon might come down south and might fly back a little bit further north, and then putz around here for a while before it really starts heading south. But well, I haven't seen loons down here on any of the lakes in Madison yet, and typically we don't see those until October. And so Lake DeBay would be up right just north of Stevens Point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that could have just even be where it's been all summer. Yeah. That would be
Or to go from Lake DeBay to Lake Tomahawk of Minocqua is not a big fly for a loon. So they may not be actually migrating. They might just be moving a little bit back and forth right now looking for food.
And where do our loons end up in after they migrate, when they go south?
They go down to places like Texas.
Southern
United States, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
And so then the loons we have here are common loons. But, you go out west, you get Pacific loons and the white-throated loon and things like that. Occasionally we'll see, a Pacific loon over here. But almost all the loons you see here are common loons.
Another David emailed, and he heard you, David, say that black bears are true hibernators. Is it true they will wake up to eat and even have cubs during, quote, quote, hibernation? How can they be true hibernators? Or has the definition of true hibernators changed?
Yeah, so fair enough. Jamie and I were just talking about this over break, and so hibernation, the fancy term for hibernation is torpor, T-O-R-P-O-R. So torpor just means it's that you are lowering your body's metabolism, you're lowering your respiration rate, your heart rate, and by doing that, you also lower your body temperature, and it's an energy-saving mechanism. So there's a broad spectrum of torpor. So, and some animals can go into torpor for just 24 hours. Some animals can go into torpor for the entire season. And so to a point of clarification, what I meant to say true hibernators, bears, what I meant to say is they hibernate for the entire season. And they do have bear young, no pun intended, but they do have young during that hibernatory period. To tell you the truth, I'm not sure if they're awake when they have the young or not. And it's very possible that they would not need to be awake to have the young, and then the young would start to suckle or milk on the mom, even though she continues to hibernate. So that I'm not aware of. And if somebody out there is a bear expert and can shed light on that point, I'd be more than willing to listen to that. But yeah, so hibernation, what I meant to say is they hibernate for the entire season, and whether they wake up or not, I am absolutely, in all honesty, I'm not completely sure about that.
Diane in Spring Green, hey, it's your turn. Thank you for calling.
Hi. The last two nights, the nighthawks have been flying over the corner of our yard that borders the garden and the cornfield, just above the tree traps in our house, and they've been crisscrossing, just gliding. It's a beautiful thing to watch for about a half an hour, and there's dragonflies doing the same with barn swallows. And my husband walked over to the garden, and he could see gnats going up, and they were just feeding up above the treetops there.
Yeah, we kind of highlighted it earlier, but yeah, so if anybody's interested in seeing if you have nighthawks around these next couple of nights, especially if we got nice clear nights, you'll either hear them or see them. And of course, they have, they're an insect eater, so they're not going to have straight flight. They're moving around like the swallows or like a bat would fly as they're catching insects.
Do they have much of a call?
They do have. I'm not good at.
I don't know.
Would you imitate Jamie? No.
Dave Botrask can maybe look one up. See,
okay.
We can get
there
find,
we go.
Find
there
a
we
night
go.
Hawk call.
They do make. It. They do make a an audible noise.
They do.
Well. Dave Botrask. He says, "Larry, what the heck are you doing here?" He'll look and see if we can find one. In the
great.
Meantime, thank you so much, Diane, for that. Appreciate it. We had an email from Joanne. But she has a couple of great horned owls in her backyard. They aren't using their normal call, but they are screeching, begging calls all night long. Why do you think they're not hooting? Are they screeching because they're hunting, and their hunting happens, and their hooting happens elsewhere?
Yeah, so great horned owls are one of the earliest nesting species in the state of Wisconsin, but typically they don't nest until, or they won't start nesting until into January. So it's a little early for them to be calling to defend territory and start attracting a mate. And the great horned owl, their call is, Jamie, you want to do that call? Since
no.
it's the traditional, what you would call it. You'd hear hoot, 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 hoot. But what happens sometimes is with young birds, just like with young children of the human species, is that they will start to utter noises and sounds as they try to start forming their sentences and words in the human species. Birds do the same thing sometimes, especially the young birds, as they're trying to figure out how to actually make that call. It's imprinted genetically inside of them, but it still takes a little bit of practice. So I'm wondering if that's maybe not what she's hearing.
I think another option is exactly what she said, is that you've got young that are being pushed out of that territory, and so they're still in the area begging from the adults. I would suspect that'll stop in a few days to a few weeks as they learn mom and dad are not helping them. They are truly on their own. But it sounds like if it's that begging call that they're just hanging around.
And then, Joanne, you'll be able to get a good night's sleep.
Yes. That's right.
There
that's
you right. go. And Dave Potratz has come up with...
Yep.
Yeah. Yep.
Nighthawk.
I can't imitate that.
Come on.
I can't do that. But it is very,
very cool. Unique. Thanks, Dave, for pulling that up. That's good.
The other cool thing about nighthawks is they nest on flat surfaces, typically where you have pebbles. And so a lot of times they'll nest on flat roofs of industrial areas like hospitals or manufacturing facilities or something like that, where you would have kind of a pebbleized type roof. And so they're a really neat bird, to have around.
Here's something more about nighthawks, I think. Tom and Stoddard, hello.
Hello, yes. We used to hear them downtown in La Crosse. We haven't been in recent years, but at night they would dive so fast you'd hear the woo, and it's the sound of their wings. They may also have a chirp of some type, but I've always associated them with that.
Yeah?
Yep.
Well, and to tie this all back together to the woodcocks, so a lot of birds will make noise through their wings, and that kind of winnowing sound you hear when woodcocks are displaying is actually the noise of the wind filtering through their tail feathers. So, yeah, that's a pretty neat, or when mourning doves take off, sometimes you'll hear that kind of squeaky sound. That's the air being pushed between their wing and their body.
Yeah. Tom, thank you. I appreciate it. We have an email from William. He says, it seems that robins are the most successful bird species in his neighborhood. Why is that? What evolutionary advantage do they have over other bird species?
They like mowed turf. That's their advantage. So they are what's called an early successional or open land species, and they feed in that low-cut turf zone, and that's where they are comfortable. And so that's why you see a lot of them. Partly because they're easy to see, because they stand out from that very, very low-cut turf. But they also are comfortable in that area. And in neighborhoods, that's what you have most of is grass.
I would say they're an adaptable species, yep, to begin with. And they have more of a generalist in terms of their selection of habitat and selection of food. So they can switch from worms to fruit if need be. We see them nest in the forest or the woods or trees in our yard, but also on top of our light fixtures. So they're very general in their requirements for habitat and food resources.
And they live a fair length of time.
Yeah, until they die.
Yeah.
So, you know, so.
But what's the average? What's the lifespan?
I don't know.
I have no idea. Yeah. If it's like most wildlife, you know, you're lucky to survive a year because of all the.
I thought it was 3 years. But
yeah, it's probably 3 or 4 years. Yeah. I would say it was probably an old robin.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Brian in Salem, it's your turn. Hi, Brian.
Yeah. Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I live down in Salem here at probably 150 yards from the Fox River. And the railroad tracks run behind our house. And there's a sliver of woods about 40 yards wide. And then there's a field just to lay out, you know, the property. And all summer there's been some sort of hawk, and sometimes there's two of them, flying around. And they make this really high-pitched screech. And I just thought it was weird. If you're trying to be, stealthy hunting, why you would make such a loud call. The only thing to think of is maybe they're trying to startle, you know, squirrels or mice to get them to move. I'm just trying to figure out what kind of bird it is. I have no idea. It's some sort of hawk or something.
Brian, does it sound a little bit like this? Kier, kier.
You know, it's really, really loud. I mean, I know it's insensitive, but I call it the rape hawk because it's just like a real, you know, like, yeah, yeah. You know, like really loud.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm wondering if it's not a red-tailed hawk. So that type of habitat you describe is an area where you'd find red-tailed hawks. And obviously they're a pretty good-sized hawk. They're about probably 2 feet tall, something like that. It's the most common hawk that people typically see. It's got, on the underside, you don't see the red of that tail as much as you see on the top side of the tail. But so I'm guessing that's probably what you're seeing. So maybe when we get off the air, look up red-tailed hawk, Google it, and see.
Yeah, Dave Potratz may be able to find a red-tailed hawk sound as well. So stay listening here.
But the other thing is, you know, for their prey, they're calling, the hawks are calling to each other.
That sounds like it.
Yeah.
It sounds like what Brian was.
Does that sound like it, Brian?
You can hear this thing from probably, you know, a half mile away.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
extremely loud, and it soars. You know, it goes with the current.
It's got to be a red-tailed hawk.
I think you did a pretty good imitation listening to one. An actual one that Dave Potrash found for us.
So, but the other issue is, you know, their prey is not necessarily going to be keyed in on that. And you think about their prey, like a rabbit is in tall grass anyway, where it feels comfortable hiding, and the hawks are still successful hunting them. So whether the hawk is calling or not, that is going to have little effect on their success in catching prey.
I saw a red tail once, I'll never forget it, flying with a very small rabbit.
And yeah.
The rabbit was screeching.
Yeah, they make that noise too, right?
They make a very screeching sound as well. Thanks, Brian. Appreciate the call. Marsha in Langley County emailed to ask if goldfinches, chickadees, nuthatches, and woodpeckers that are seen in winter months in northern Wisconsin overwinter here, or are they have migrated from more northerly locations in Canada, for example?
Nope. All those birds overwinter here. So we have about 400 bird species in the state of Wisconsin, roughly, and about 85% of those leave our state in the wintertime. But the birds you mentioned, goldfinches, chickadees, nuthatches, and most of the woodpeckers, so will all overwinter here. They're called state resident species. They're here year-round. The red-headed woodpecker will occasionally migrate, but most of the other woodpecker species are here throughout all 12 months.
Let's go to Rick in New Glarus next. Hi, Rick. Oh, we lost Rick. Okay, well, I want to go back to Nighthawks for just a minute and return to them because we were talking about their size and so forth. And John, who's near the mouth of the Peshtigo River, called to say that Nighthawk wingspan is 20 to 23 inches and the body is 9 inches. Does that sound about right to you?
You know what? I'm awful at estimating size like that. So it could be. It seems a little long, a little large. The wingspan seems a little large to me. But I'll tell you, if Jamie, I don't know if you have anything to mention. I'm going to see if I can find it really quick on Merlin. Another.
Well, let's talk about the bird apps.
Yeah,
because that's what David's going to check it out on. So we wanted to talk a little bit about wildlife apps, but there's been a lot of questions on birds on the show, and I think it would make sense to share a few. And I personally use iBird Pro, and it's an app that you do pay for. I want to say it was maybe $15 or so that you download on either an Android or an iPhone. And you're able to, so it's basically a field guide within your phone, but it's different than a field guide in that you have the ability to search by different categories. So instead of flipping through the field guide and looking at maybe if you know what family it's in, or the gentleman that called and thought it was a hawk, he may have started in the hawk pages. But if he'd have the app, he'd look at family and he would toggle the on-off button that he thought it was a hawk. You'd look at beak shape and he could find the shape that looks like the hawk. The shape and length of the wings, flight pattern, so that bird was a soarer. Primary colors, the location. You can enter the state that you're in, or if you're in a backyard or urban area or by a lake or a forest. So by toggling, the more things you toggle, you go down from about 900 species in the iBird Pro app to as few as you can decipher, and then you can look through those. So maybe you get it down to 9, and then you can look through them. And you decide, oh, it's that red-tailed hawk. And you click on it. And then within iBird Pro, they offer both illustrations or photos of the bird, the recordings. So we could get the audio recordings that Dave's been doing here for us. Range maps. And another function I really like is similar species. So it'll quickly say, if somebody lands on the red-tailed hawk, what are some things that you may be confusing it with? And you can look through those. I just find they're super helpful, and it's one less field guide you're carrying around because it's all in your phone.
For sure. And I will add to that, my daughter was just in Iceland, and she was texting me, what bird is this, what bird is that? And so I said, hey, download Merlin, and that's the app I use is Merlin. And it's a worldwide app, so you can find birds all over the world with it, so which is pretty cool. Back to John's question, however. Jamie, nice stall on that. So I was able to find enough information. So the wingspan on a common nighthawk is 20.9 to 22.4 inches long, and that shocks me because I didn't think the wingspan was that big, but that's apparently so nearly 2 feet.
So
that's
John was impressive. Pretty close when he said 20 to 23.
Yeah, very close.
That's very
10
very
on the side plus your body. Yep.
I wouldn't have guessed that, but that's a decent wingspan.
Mike in Appleton, hi.
Hey, how are you?
Good, appreciate your call.
Well, thank you very much. Hey, I'm really interested in what our current knowledge is about the state of the ruffled grouse population and the cause of the big decline last year, and what do you think the population is going to be like this year?
So, Mike...
looks more positive,
doesn't it? It looks more positive, but it's one data point at this point. So what we have is the spring drumming surveys were up in the neighborhood of 40% compared to last year where we saw the decline. Still collecting information from hunters. It seems like, at least from me having conversations, it's either I've seen more grouse or I've seen fewer grouse. I don't see anything conclusive there. However, there is a couple of things to come out of that. One, the state is working on its first ever rough grouse management plan. So that, along with the state agencies and partner groups, that is being worked on. I know right now there's discussion amongst the Natural Resources Board in terms of what they're going to do with the rough grouse hunting season, whether they're going to choose to close it early like they did last year. Don't know if the... science is there, the data supports that, but it would be a conservative measure until we can figure out what's going on. And then in addition, there is continuing of the West Nile virus sampling going on between Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Michigan. So folks who are hunting rough grouse can get a sampling kit to be able to take, I believe they harvest some feathers to submit for sampling of West Nile virus, and for those that don't hunt but maybe come across a grouse in a poor state, again, that would be a bird that the local biologist would be interested in receiving and being able to collect that as a sample. So I think we'll hear more here because, again, we have to make a decision on the rough grouse hunting season for the year. We don't have back the West Nile virus results from last year's hunting season, at least that I've seen publicly. So
there we go. Thank you very much, Mike, for calling. I want to go back to Joanne, who emailed about the great horned owls in her backyard that they were screeching, begging all night long. Mm-hmm. She emailed again to say that the owls have been doing this in spring.
That would then
just be begging behavior.
Yeah, that would go more to what Jamie's explanation was about the begging behavior. Yep.
So Joanne, sooner or later,
those adults almost have those kids out of the house.
Yeah, right.
Almost.
Yeah, you're going to. And have a good night's sleep soon.
But she's going to go from begging behavior to courtship
hoot,
behavior here, mating behavior here shortly. So
that'll be, that starts up in about a month or two.
Yeah.
A couple months, I think. Yeah,
probably by October, near the end of October for sure.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, we are about out of time. I want to thank you both very much for being with us again.
Thank you.
You're going to be back in Scott Craven will be back October 2nd, and then you guys are back again on November 6th.
Yep.
So look forward to that. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
David Drake, professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison and a UW Extension wildlife specialist. Jamie Knack, a UW Extension senior wildlife outreach specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. They'll be back. Well, Scott's back on October 2nd. They'll be back on November 6th, always the first Wednesday of the month. Tomorrow, Kathleen Ernst is back to talk about her latest Chloe Ellefson mystery book. I just finished reading it. It was a lot of fun. And then at 11:45, our barbecue masters, Mad Dog and Merrill, give us some tips on tailgate grilling. Stay with us. Lots more in store. I'm Larry Mueller.